KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. There are 128 open schools in rural Alaska, and the state owns just under half of them. Reporter Emily Schwing dug through data and found decades of neglect and lacking accountability that's put students, teachers, and staff at risk.
Most school districts in Alaska have access to money that doesn't come from the state, but rural school districts are different.
We do not have a tax base. Most of our community members are families. They live a subsistence lifestyle.
Madeline Aguilar is the superintendent of 9 schools scattered across 12,000 square miles in Alaska's interior. It's roughly the size of Maryland. Her district relies on the state to help pay for everything from textbooks to sewer lines.
The state does have an obligation to provide a public education. Providing that education would also mean assistance with providing the physical space.
Since 1998, Alaska has only funded about 14% of nearly 1,800 project proposals from rural school districts. The result? Exposed electrical wiring and malfunctioning fire alarms. In one case, the school's pipes froze and broke, so for most of the last school year, kids rode a four-wheeler, known as the bathroom bus, home twice a day to relieve themselves.
I think the evidence speaks for itself.
Bryce Edgman, an Alaska native, is speaker of the Alaska State House of Representatives.
And these bright young children show up every morning to go to school in a building that's not fit for even anything but being ready to be demolished.
Regulations say the state is responsible for major maintenance and construction for buildings it owns. Alaska's Education Commissioner Dina Bishop says it's not that simple.
The funding for those projects comes from the state of Alaska's legislature that would provide funding.
This year, requests for investments in school infrastructure statewide come close to $800 million as a budget deficit looms in Alaska. And lawmakers in Juneau are debating over how to balance the budget and fund education.
Emily Schwing reports for KYUK. Support for this reporting comes from ProPublica and the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2024 National Fellowship. Indigenous business owners are gathering in a major conference in the Mountain West region this week to discuss ways to bring more business opportunities to Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has more.
Thousands of Indigenous entrepreneurs are gathered in Las Vegas for the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development Conference, the biggest of its kind in the country. The acting director of the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, Brian Mercier, spoke to the group. He acknowledged many conference goers are concerned about Trump administration budget cuts, but said the new administration is also working to enhance opportunities for Indigenous businesses and communities. He told the crowd that energy and economic development are on the table, along with funding law enforcement. He went on to say he's encouraging everybody he speaks with to, quote, jump at these opportunities and work with this administration. Mercier is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. He said in his role, he will continue to advocate for prioritizing Indigenous cultural perspectives in federal policy. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
And it was roughly 5 years ago this week that COVID-19 came to North America. A Princeton University study has shown that Native people saw greater rates of COVID-19 deaths due to limited access to high-quality medical care, poverty, and crowded living conditions. Tribes shut down many operations and organized vaccine clinics and pop-up testing sites to protect elders and children. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Support by DT Track, your healthcare partner, providing access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. DT Track will be at the Reservation Economic Summit, booth 214.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Schools have been waiting. They have cut the fat. They have cut the flesh. And we are now cutting into the bone of our education system.
The Alaska House passes a bill with the largest long-term school funding increase in about a decade. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, researchers say a volcano near Anchorage is likely to erupt soon.
Explosive eruptions that fragment magma and shoot ash, 50,000 feet into the atmosphere.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The Alaska House narrowly approved a bill today that would substantially increase state funding for public schools on a long-term basis for the first time in nearly a decade. House Bill 69 would increase the so-called base student allocation by $1,000. Lawmakers estimate it will raise public education spending roughly $275 million next school year. Sitka Independent Representative and former teacher Rebecca Himshut says it's an effort to find common ground with the governor and Republicans in the House and Senate's minority caucuses.
This bill is a wonderful compromise. Schools have been waiting. They have cut the fat. They have cut the flesh. And we are now cutting into the bone of our education system. It is time to act, and this bill provides that opportunity.
Boosting education funding was a key campaign issue for members of the Democrat-heavy majority caucus. Parents, teachers, students, and community leaders have pleaded with lawmakers to increase school funding for years. But Governor Mike Dunleavy has said on numerous occasions he would not support a bill that raised education funding without policy changes aimed at boosting student achievement. Majority lawmakers added a number of education policy changes to the bill after negotiations with the governor's staff. Most notably, lawmakers added a reading-focused incentive program. Republicans' opposition to the bill concentrated on a few key areas. Many, like Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance, say they're not satisfied with the policy changes added to the bill.
I want to be clear. I fully support adequate funding for education in Alaska, but funding alone without meaningful reform is insufficient.
Others objected to what they saw as an inadequate public process. Some said they're concerned it could force a trade-off between education spending and Alaskans' permanent fund dividends. The bill now heads to the Senate, where it's expected to continue to evolve. For one thing, it's unclear whether the $1,000 increase in basic per-student funding will survive intact. That's as the state faces budget deficits in excess of $500 million. Senate Education Committee Chair Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat, says they have not quite settled on what the increase should be.
We recognize and understand that there are fiscal constraints. We do have and have offered multiple solutions on how we might be able to get to a higher number, including introduction of several revenue bills, which we think should be a part of the conversation.
Dunleavy said last week before the bill passed that the House's changes represented, quote, positive movement, but he stopped short of endorsing it. His spokesperson did not return a request for an updated statement this afternoon. The likelihood of a volcano's explosive eruption not far from a huge chunk of Alaska's population has increased, according to researchers. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on the unrest at Mount Spur.
Alaska volcano researchers like Matt Haney have had their eyes on Mount Spur for months.
It started almost a year ago with increased amounts of earthquakes beneath the volcano. and we've been tracking that closely.
Haney is the scientist in charge at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. He says researchers also observed that the surface of Mount Spur was inflating outwards. Movements escalated in the summer when researchers saw snow on the summit of the volcano begin to melt and form a turquoise lake. Then, on Friday and Tuesday, researchers flew over the volcano where they sampled gases venting from the volcano. Between the increase in gases, quakes, the melting of snow, and the inflating surface, Haney says signs are pretty good that Spur will erupt in the coming weeks or months.
It's almost like we have a checklist of the usual signs that volcanoes give us before they progress to an eruption, and now we're seeing all four of those are giving us those indicators.
Mount Spur is about 80 miles west of Anchorage and the closest active volcano to Alaska's population centers. It erupted twice historically, once in 1953 and again in 1992.
When we consider many different scenarios, including the scenario that the volcano may not ultimately erupt or other eruption scenarios, we now consider it the most likely scenario to be eruptions like occurred in 1953 and 1992 at Spur.
Haney says the most likely scenario is an eruption not from the summit of Mount Spur, but at an opening about 2 miles away called Crater Peak.
The eruptions of Mount Spur in 1953 and in 1992 were from Crater Peak. And when they flew around Crater Peak, they did not measure sulfur dioxide gas in excess of background there, but they did measure carbon dioxide, which is indicative of magma intruding beneath Mount Spur in Crater Peak in particular.
Spur remains at a yellow advisory status, as it has since October. But Haney and other researchers now predict an explosive eruption rather than lava running down the volcano.
More often than not, we have explosive eruptions that fragment magma and shoot ash, 50,000 feet into the atmosphere.
Those explosions could last for as long as a few hours and produce ash clouds carried for hundreds of miles. That ash is known to shut down jet engines and cause severe damage to plane exteriors. And Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport is one of the busiest air cargo hubs in the world. In December 1989, a 747 flew through ash from another nearby volcano, Mount Redoubt, and the plane's engines shut down, forcing an emergency landing in Anchorage with 231 passengers aboard. On the ground, the ash would also be the most immediate danger to residents, says State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zittick.
Ash is not good for people to breathe. It's not good for you to get on your skin. And so what we want people to do during the volcanic eruption is really minimize their exposure to that ash as much as possible. Mask up if they do have to go outside.
Zittick says the ash can also impact visibility on the roads and damage vehicles, so residents should limit their driving in the event of an eruption. Haney, the volcano researcher, says an eruption could come with little or no additional warning and pose a risk to people closer to the volcano within about 15 or 20 miles.
There would be more proximal hazards like hot flows of ash and gas called pyroclastic flows that would go down the slopes of the volcano. There can also be volcanic mud flows called lahars.
Though the eruption has the potential to temporarily impact air travel, Zittick with the state says he doesn't anticipate widespread impacts.
While we need to be mindful of it and take steps to prevent breathing it, we don't anticipate we're going to see widespread power outages, our water supplies being contaminated. We don't anticipate that air travel will be canceled for weeks.
So while Mount Spur's unrest comes with some risks, Haney says there should be ways for residents to see the eruption from a safe distance at Anchorage's Point Warrensoff.
When it comes into Anchorage, it will be almost like a sandstorm with dark ash. It will, if it occurs in daylight, it'll block out the sun.
If it comes at night, Haney says onlookers can be in for a different visual spectacle.
It can produce a large amount of lightning. We call it volcanic lightning. It's due to charges getting set up by the ash particles scraping up next to each other.
More information on how residents can prepare for an eruption is available on the State Emergency Division website, ready.alaska.gov. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a trio of mushers battle for the lead in the last stretches of the Iditarod.
enjoying myself, you know. May as well be caught up in the moment, not the what's 2 days down the line, you know.
That Iditarod update coming. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report, with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
The tribal governments of St. Lawrence Island and the Bering Sea say they're living with the toxic legacy of Cold War military installations on their land. Today, they took their complaint to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Toxics and Human Rights. At a press conference in Washington, D.C., tribal leaders spoke about troubling health problems on the island. Vi Waghi works with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. She says her family lived on the most contaminated location, the Northeast Cape, for 5 years when she was growing up.
I'm a cancer survivor. I've had 3 miscarriages. I'm 66. My mother had a low birth. I'm sorry. My mother had a stillborn child after me. Heart disease, strokes, diabetes, and cancer. Her name was Della Waghi. I want to say their name.
Sandra Galagergen from Savunga says her father and his brother salvaged building materials from the Northeast Cape and, unaware of the contamination risk, built a cabin.
And we stayed there every summer, not knowing. My father and his brother always worked and camped together. And then they both died of cancer 3 months apart.
The Yupik people of St. Lawrence Island have PCB levels in their blood up to 9 times higher than the average in lower 48 communities. Alaska Community Action on Toxics recognizes that much of that is not attributed to the military, but says research shows that those who lived near the Northeast Cape have higher PCB levels than residents in other parts of the island. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers spent more than $130 million to clean up the island and considered the work largely done a decade ago. The Army Corps did not have an immediate response for this story. The state cites a federal report that says the contamination from the former military sites does not present an unacceptable health risk. St. Lawrence leaders call the cleanup superficial. It may seem like the Trump administration is not inclined to order a new cleanup. News broke today that the administration intends to close all offices of environmental justice in the Environmental Protection Agency. But attorney Claudia Polsky, who helped write the St. Lawrence complaint, says the law still applies.
And whether we call it environmental justice, whether we call it hazardous waste cleanup, whether we call it something else, there is still a law domestically that is being violated and that is enforceable, and this is the time to make it happen.
The complaint is now in the hands of the UN Special Rapporteur, an independent expert. He can't order a cleanup, but his work could add pressure to the federal agencies. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced Tuesday that all recently terminated probationary employees were to be rehired with back pay starting today. That was to comply with a deadline imposed by an independent federal board. The Merit Systems Protections Board ordered the department to temporarily reinstate the roughly 6,000 USDA workers who have been fired in recent weeks. That total reportedly includes more than 3,400 Forest Service workers, a USDA branch with an outsized footprint here in Alaska. Matt Brossard is with a union that represents federal employees nationwide. He says the fired workers will be reinstated on paid administrative leave for now.
So they're working on a plan to get them back in their normal positions and off of administrative leave immediately.
But the reinstatements are temporary. The Merit Systems Protection Board acts as an internal court to consider federal employees' complaints against the government. Last week, the board found that the firings had likely been illegal and ordered USDA to rehire the workers for 45 days while an investigation plays out. In the weeks since the terminations happened, some employees may have made other plans or moved on. Brossard says the workers are being automatically reinstated, so if they no longer want the job, they'll likely have to resign.
You know, we could have had people that moved away because they couldn't afford to live where they were and they moved back home or, you know, out of Alaska or wherever they were working.
Communities across Alaska have been protesting federal firings in recent weeks, especially within the Forest Service, which is a major employer in many Southeast communities. Among other things, employees work to maintain the Tongass, the nation's largest national forest. And two leases for National Park Service offices in Fairbanks had been on the chopping block as part of major cuts to federal spending, but now the U.S. General Services Administration is reversing course. As KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports, that means all three lessees at the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitor Center are staying put, at least for now.
The last couple of weeks have sent lease agreements for Park Service workspaces in Fairbanks on a bit of a roller coaster ride. At the end of February, the U.S. General Services Administration separately notified landlords that it was canceling leases with them for two NPS offices in town. One of those leases was for the Alaska Public Lands Information Center, or APLIC, at the Morris Thompson Center, and the other was for the Park Service Administrative Center on Geist Road. The early end for the leases came as a result of the nationwide cost-cutting initiative backed by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. But as of Monday, those two cancellations in Fairbanks have themselves been canceled. Tanya Klukas is the executive director at the Morris Thompson Center, which leases space to APLIC. She received an email from the GSA Monday afternoon officially stating that the APLIC lease at Morris Thompson will remain intact.
And the text says that our lease number is in full force and effect.
Jerry Sadler owns the Geist Road building that houses the NPS Administrative Center, and he also confirmed Tuesday that the GSA had walked back its initial notice, terminating that lease. And for Klukas, that email marked a welcome change.
Tension that I had been carrying in my shoulders since the initial lease termination was released.
Less than 2 weeks ago, the message from the GSA had been the opposite, when agency officials had said they were backing out of the APLIC lease at Morris Thompson about 2.5 years ahead of schedule. That lease is set to expire in 2028. Klukas had challenged the early termination, writing back to the GSA in early March that Fairbanks must have an APLIC office due to the Alaska National Interests Land Conservation Act, or ANILCA. And she also credits Alaska's three-person congressional delegation for their advocacy efforts over the past week.
All of our congressional delegation was instrumental in making this happen, and especially Senator Sullivan's office.
Alongside a couple other lessees, APLIC has been stationed inside Morris Thompson since 2008, and its lease constitutes 40% of the Cultural Center's annual operating budget. And while Monday's email from GSA resolves Klukas' concern for the time being, she says there's still some uncertainty as to how things will pan out during lease renewal negotiations.
At this point in time, many of our contacts at GSA are no longer with GSA, so we're not at this time sure who we'll be working with, but anybody who's there and available, we're more than willing to work with.
In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, keeping schools and students connected across the state with a resilient and redundant network. Details at gci.com/education. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to healthcare in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The Anchorage School Board voted unanimously last week to prohibit the use of portable electronic devices for the entire school day for elementary and middle school students. High schoolers are allowed to use their phones during passing periods and lunch only. Nationwide, many school districts are moving to limit cell phone use by students, citing the negative impacts to student learning and mental health. Principals at Wendler Middle School, South High School, and a growing number of other schools around the state independently banned phones during class over the last several years. Anchorage School Board member Margo Bellamy noted that part of the policy's updated language came from students.
I did have the opportunity last week to meet with a group of students over at Wendler, and we had a conversation about the cell phones, and all of them agreed we needed to have a cell phone policy.
Three separate bills moving through the legislature would prohibit student cell phone use in school. The Alaska Board of Education and Early Development released a draft statewide cell phone policy in January that also limits use to before and after school. The new policy for Anchorage students lists smartwatches and earbuds among the portable electronic devices banned from the classroom. It makes exceptions for disabled and developmentally challenged students, as well as students whose first language is not English. Individual school principals can also make the policy more restrictive if they choose. The board's previous policy language prohibited using cell phones to cheat in class or bully other students, but had not been updated since 2012. Board members said if any of the more prohibitive bills become state law, they would vote to realign their policy with the new state standards. Well, today is Ashley Johnson Barr Day in Alaska. It's named in remembrance of a Kotzebue girl who was assaulted and murdered in 2018. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen spoke with Ashley's father about her legacy.
Throughout the Northwest Arctic and the state, residents dress head to toe in purple clothes and paint their nails purple. Numerous organizations post Ashley Johnson Barr's photo on social media with purple tones or hearts to remember her. Purple was her favorite color. In 2020, the Alaska legislature established March 12th as Ashley Johnson Barr Day to honor the late Kotzebue girl on her birthday. Ashley's father, Scotty Barr, says the day and Ashley's memory have sparked larger conversations about missing and murdered people across Alaska.
Ever since the bill has been passed, I feel like a lot of entities, as well as close families that lost their loved ones, they are willing to go and finally speak up. It was hiding for decades and centuries, hush-hush.
In 2018, 10-year-old Ashley was abducted from a park in Kotzebue that's now named after her. After an intensive 8-day search, Ashley's body was found outside of town on the tundra. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled. Ashley's killer was convicted and sentenced to 99 years in prison. Barr says Ashley went to church every day, enjoyed swimming, playing basketball, and berry picking. He hopes Ashley is remembered for her kindness.
She was a very loving person, very loving, kind, young 10-year-old, and she just fell in love with everybody. Everybody knew her. She had a warm, welcoming smile. Her heart was pure.
In the years since Ashley's death, there have been several state and federal actions to address the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis. On the federal level, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski sponsored Savannah's Act and co-sponsored the Not Invisible Act, which aimed to improve data collection and coordination between tribes, law enforcement, the federal government, and survivors. Both were signed into law in 2020. Last year in Alaska, legislation was signed into law that made several public policy changes and led to the establishment of an MMIP task force. Barr says that there has been good progress, but change is also needed on more personal levels.
You know, we live in a tough and evil world, so we have to go and educate and bring awareness to our loved ones on a daily basis and educate our young men as well, too. That's the biggest one is right there. Just respect the young ladies and women, their sisters, their mothers, their grandparents, their grandmas, their aunts.
Barr says that's what he hopes others carry with them, and that people not only remember his daughter, but also
many other families that are still going through the same, trying to seek justice, trying to seek their loved ones, trying to find their loved ones.
Ashley Johnson Barr would have been 17 this year. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
It's neck and neck and neck between the top Iditarod Trail sled dog race teams as they run up the Bering Sea coast in the final quarter of the race. Jesse Holmes was first into Koyuk this morning at about 11:30, and Matt Hall arrived late this afternoon, passing Holmes and slipping into the lead a little after 4. As Holmes prepared to give chase, the third-place team of Paige Drobny arrived in Koyuk a little before 4:30 p.m. That's been the lead pack, Holmes, Hall, and Drobny. And as Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, the fight for first place has been a game of leapfrog.
More than 100 Alaskans greeted Jesse Holmes and his 11-dog team as they raced into the Unalakleet checkpoint in first place last night. Holmes pumped his arms in the air and cheered as he pulled in.
Enjoying myself, you know. May as well be caught up in the moment, not the what's 2 days down the line, you know.
Holmes and veterans Matt Hall and Paige Drobny are battling up the Bering Sea coast to be the first musher in Nome. The three have been leapfrogging the top three positions for hundreds of miles, and they're all chasing their first Iditarod win. Holmes has placed as high as third in his prior Iditarods. Hall was last year's runner-up, and Drobny's best finish is fifth. All three mushers are from interior Alaska, and all three did not spend much time in Unalakleet. Holmes stopped for just over 10 minutes to feed his team a snack, grab a couple of bottles of heat to power his stove, and a bale of straw to camp further up the trail. He also accepted prizes for his first place arrival to the checkpoint, gold nuggets and 2 wood-carved loons by a local artist. Then he was off. Almost exactly an hour later, veteran Matt Hall and his 10 dogs arrived in Unalakleet. He immediately ripped open his sled to show the checkpoint manager he had all the required gear.
Okay, green snowshoes on the bottom.
Yeah, there. Snowshoes check, cooker check.
Cooker check, vet book's in your hand, right?
Vet book
right
check.
There. Axe right here.
Axe. Stand.
Trail mail.
Check, trail mail.
Before he races off, he gets a pizza delivery. A local restaurant, Peace on Earth, has a tradition where fans worldwide can order pizza from ushers. He got one from a 5th grade class in Wisconsin.
Oh boy, here in 2 minutes, I'm going to wolf that down.
Hall and his dogs didn't stay long either. They have just over 250 miles left on the trail.
It's almost over, so I'm feeling great.
Drobny, meanwhile, was resting on the trail when Holmes and Hall passed through Unalakleet. She later raced in around 1 a.m. with 13 dogs. She sent one home because it had diarrhea, she said. It was a quick high and bye. She was back on the trail with her barking dogs within 4 minutes.
Hey, guys. Ready? Let's go. Thank you.
And they sprinted off, chasing down Hall and Holmes. A winner is expected tomorrow night. In Unalakleet, I'm Ava White.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Wesley Early and Tim Rocky in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Michael Finelli in Ketchikan, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, Desiree Hagan in Kotzebue, and Ava White in Unalakleet. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
This is for the busted hearts. This is for the question marks. This is for the outcast soul, lost control, no one knows. Sing it for the can't go back. Sing it for the broken past.
Sing a fool that just found out life is now upside down. If you're looking for hope tonight, raise your hand. If you feel alone and don't understand. If you're fighting the fight of your life, then stand. We're gonna make it through this hand in hand. And if we fall, we will fall together. Together.
This is for the second chance. This is for the new romance. Singing for the left in vain. Overcame, it's not too late.
Together we are bolder, braver, stronger.
I can make you love me. Turn down the lights, turn down the bed, turn down these voices inside my head. Hold me close.
we don't have a chance tonight.
Lucifer is lonely, standing there, killing time. Can't commit to anything but a crime. Leaders on vacation, an open invitation. Animals, evidence. Pearly gates look more like a picket fence. Once you get inside, I've got friends but can't invite them. Hills burn in California. My turn to ignore ya. Yeah. Don't say I didn't warn ya. Yeah. All the good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself has enemies. And once the water starts to rise,
and heaven's out of sight. She'll want the devil on her teeth. My love's your first love. Look at you, needing me. You know I'm not your friend without some greenery. Walking wearing feathers, Peter should know better. Your cover-up is caving in. Man is such a fool, why are we saving him? Poisoning themselves now, begging for our help. Wow, hills burn in California. My turn to ignore ya. Don't say I didn't warn ya. All the good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself has enemies. And once the water starts to rise and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team. My love's so far is lonely.
I cannot do this, snowflake.
Came in the door, chucked in my coat, and who I'm looking for is there. so don't think it's in the past. These kind of wounds, they last and they last. Now, did you think it all through? All these things will catch up to you. And time can heal, but this won't. So if you're coming my way, just don't. Oh, it's so sad to think about the good. Sorry, just for show. If you live like that, you live with ghosts. Band-aids don't fix bullet holes. You say sorry, just for show. If you live like that, you live with ghosts. If you love like that,
on. This is Dmitry Filimonov, President and CEO of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
Over the last 5 years, APIA's Tribal Child Support Program has collected and distributed nearly $1.5 million, with 100% of those funds going to parents raising our next generation. We offer flexible and holistic case management to families. All residents of the Regional 10 communities are eligible for this alternative to state child support. To apply, please go to apiai.org or call 1-800-478-2742.
Remember, if you are in Anchorage, please come visit the Unangamulla, home of the Aleuts. Unangam, Atakan, Akun, we are one.
This message brought to you by the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association.
Radio straight up out of my bed. I couldn't get it out of my head. I drove down Highway 9. Must have heard it three more times. Forget the words, but I got the gist. I think it went something like this. Yeah. Sand, kicking it, 3 day weekend. A lot of rocking, a little rolling, suntan lotion, love potion. DJ came on, said the phone's been ringing all day long. For this one, it's a hit. I bring it up and I raise my fist, yeah.
keep fighting voices in my mind that say I'm not enough. Every single lie that tells me I will never measure up. Am I more than just the sum of every high and every low? Remind me once again just who I am, because I need to know.